All right, welcome. Tonight is how to get paid a bonus for working less. And the question tonight that I want to talk about is what if you could work fewer hours and not only keep your income but actually get a bonus? And where this comes from for me was in 2006, I was running sales and marketing at a small optics company. And that was the year that I traveled the country doing another type of sales. We were actually selling the company. And as it became clear to me that the sale of the company was going to go through and we were going to have new owners and there was kind of uncertainty, I started to wonder, you know, what's going to happen to me. But after the sale went through, I decided the best course of action for myself would be to give myself a demotion. So mm-hmm. instead of running sales and marketing, I would be on my own working as a business development guy myself. And it would give me a chance not to manage people anymore and to do some new things and free up some time. And so that led to a bunch of good things for me, and I'll talk about those tonight. So let me go through the call logistics. So it's meant to be interactive. Please jump in and ask questions or make comments at any time. And I'm recording this, so please use your first name and introduce yourself whenever you make a comment. And to mute yourself, use *6 and unmute, just press *6 again, and I'll be putting the recording up tomorrow after we get done. So I wanted to start out with just some question for the group, and that is, who are you? So if you had one word to describe yourself, what would you describe yourself as? So I'm a dad or a photographer or a sales guy or something. Hey, who just joined in?
It's Regina. Sorry, I'm
late. Hey, Regina. That's all right. How's it going?
Great, thanks.
Hey, Regina, so you just called in. I was just about to do introductions, and what I want you to do is just give me like one word to describe yourself. Not that sums you up, but just one thing about you that describes something about who you are.
Passionate.
Perfect. Olivia, how about you? If you're in a place where you can unmute.
Mm-hmm. Adventurous.
Okay, cool. And so those are great descriptive words, and I'm sure y'all could go on and on and on, right? Because there's a lot of things that you both do and are involved in and care about. So this is kind of a recap of last week. But so all those things about you, you know, you're adventurous, you're passionate, you know, plus, you know, you're connected to people and you help people exercise, Olivia, and Regina, you help people sell their company better. I mean, those are all things that are part of you. But the point I wanted to emphasize again from last week is that you are not your job. You are a lot of things, but you're not your job. And that's the thing that is really important for this week when we talk about how to think differently about your work and how it fits into your life. And so the model that I really want to help frame this up tonight is the model of people like Michelangelo and back in the Renaissance. And for them, they didn't have jobs really. They had patrons. So Michelangelo was really close with the Medici family in northern Italy. And they basically commissioned him to do different works that he did. And so he didn't have to have a day job, and he didn't have to do other work that would distract him from working on his art. And in fact, when I was looking into this, he had one commission that actually took him 40 years to get finished. The Pope hired him to make basically a really fancy casket for him. But the reason it took 40 years is because he kept getting interrupted by other projects he was working on. So he had these people who were patrons for him that gave him the money to do what he wanted to do, but he still had the freedom to go off and do his art. It wasn't all about the job for them. So this is how I want you all and us to think about the role of work in our lives, is less like what we are, who we are, or less like the prime focus of our life, and more like a patron that's funding us to be who we really are, which is probably something really different maybe than what we're doing in any given year or any given job for what we're doing. So another way to think about work is like you want it to be like a Daddy Warbucks from the musical Annie who's handing you money so that you can go off and be this artist or this, to use that analogy, instead of a slave driver who's just making you stressed out. And with a lot of that stress coming because you really identify yourself with that job and with what you're doing. So we'll keep that model in mind as I talk a little bit more about how do we start to continue to make more time out of our day jobs to fund our development of our passions outside of work. So what I want to talk about now is like how do you find your sort of sweet spot in your job, and that's the place where you can give the most value to your employer with the least amount of stress and energy. And we started talking about that last week, and just the two kind of principles that we use around this that we talked about last week. Well, the first one is that value is not a function of the time you put in. And last week I talked about the example of going to a restaurant and you have a waiter who comes to your table. And you might have a waiter who's really friendly and chatty but doesn't do a very good job of getting your food out while it's warm and keeping your glasses full. But I also had and so that's a waiter who's putting a lot of time in but is not adding a lot of value. And then I gave the example of this French waiter we had when I was in Paris who was a little bit snotty, a little rude maybe, but very excellent waiter, telling you what you ought to have. The food was already there, and he was just everything you'd want in terms of an efficient waiter. And so he was adding a lot of value, but with not much time. So that's the first principle. Then the second principle is that work doesn't have to feel like work. And that's the example I gave of that was my mailman Gary, who loves what he's doing, and would probably, if you could make up a job description of the mail guy, that is somebody who walks around and chats with everybody and knows everybody and cares about everybody. That's kind of what he is. He really kind of is what his job is. And so if you keep those two kind of principles in mind, that how much value you're giving to your company is not necessarily a function of how many hours you put in. And then that, just because it's called work doesn't mean it has to feel like work. And that means that if you can find the things that you do that you like to do, then you're going to reduce the stress level at work. So does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what I want to talk tonight the most about is what I call downshifting. This is point number two, I guess, on the outline that I sent you guys. And 2 weeks ago, it was a nice sunny day here in Charlotte, and I decided that it was a Friday afternoon, and I wanted to go drive a convertible. So I was thinking about, how can I do that? And I thought for a while, I didn't really know anybody who had one who would let me drive it, and I thought, I could go do a test drive. So why don't I go down to the little Porsche dealership and see if I can get them to take me out in one of their cars. So I drove out there and got there, and given the economy, they are not very busy right now, so they were happy to see me. And so we picked out this little shiny black two-seater convertible, and he pulled it out, and we put the top back. And then he took me out on these really windy roads that were near where we were. And as we were driving, he was telling me how the car operates, and you can shift back down from third gear into second gear. It's a manual shift car. And that car is made to really have a big range of power in that when you shift down like that. So you can go from going into a turn, you can actually shift down in a second and really punch the car. And it'll go really fast and will really kind of hug the curve as you go along. And so, I was just loving driving this car on a sunny day. And it handled completely different from my sedan that has automatic shifting. And so the Porsche, the equivalent of that kind of being able to downshift into a lower gear in your job, what the equivalent to that is really moving from a role of maybe greater responsibility or management responsibility or real high visibility back to a job that where you have more flexibility in what you do, more ability to use the things that you're good at so work doesn't feel like work. And also kind of one thing that when you downshift a car is that you have more traction. And so, the equivalent to the job is that you have more ability to add value to the company with less pressure in your job. So for downshifting in a car is a lot of fun. Downshifting in a job, though, can be a little bit scary because it's not what is generally expected of people. Generally, you know, you move up in the company, you get promotion. If you do a good job, they give you more responsibility. And if you love what you're doing and you really want to move up and you love being a manager, that's great. If you're in a job and you feel like that you could do more and you're not feeling passionate about the work anymore, then that added responsibility that'll keep coming to you as long as you'll take it because you're a good employee, all that responsibility will just make it more and more stressful and less likely that you're going to have time to go explore these things that really could add meaning to your life and could take you on that path to get to a job that pays you and lets you use your passion. So there's a couple of ways that you can do downshifting, and we're going to talk about some tactical things you can do right now and then some other kind of bigger strategies for that. But what I want to talk about first is really the fears. So what would happen if I were to go to my boss and say, you know, I really don't want to take this big project anymore. I want to hand this thing back. And so let me ask that. What do you guess if I think about, you know, going and talking to your boss and you raise your hand and say, you know, I really don't want to be the manager of your department anymore. I really like to go back to what I did a couple of years ago and do that. What does that bring to mind for you guys?
Oh my gosh. You want to go first, Olivia?
No, go ahead.
Well, you're the adventure. I don't know. Gosh. I'm speechless.
No, talk more about that. That's great. That's a good reaction.
Are you saying what would I like to say or?
No. I mean, if you like visualize in your head doing something like that, what kind of fears would you start to feel? I guess that's what I'm really asking. What's your gut reaction to that proposal from me? That you do that?
Oh gosh. Well, the sheer shock of it, of course, that I already showed you. I guess I would be afraid that, you know, everybody wants you to be a team player and all the rest. So, you know, if she doesn't want to do this, you know, I may not be able to control her into doing the things that we need her to do as a company or as me as her boss. You know, and I'm not sure I'd want somebody like that around. I'm speaking as my fear of my boss would be saying if they're not totally, you know, grounded in who they are, it could really cause some problems for me, just to be honest.
Yeah. Okay. That is you're really worried about do you lose your job? Is are you going to take yourself out of the valued employee role?
Yeah, because people are so used to, you know, you do what I tell you to do, and if not, there's 10 other people who are willing to do it if you're not, so we'll see you, bye-bye.
Yeah. Okay, cool. How about you, Olivia? I really want to hear from you because you've worked in the culture of up or out, you know? That's got to be a massive
And everyone would probably agree that that I was the one that was afraid. So that being said, definitely, you know, you want to be a yes person. You know, that would feel extremely risky. You know, what comes top of mind is, and just so present for me right now, is everyone's definition of success in corporate America seems to be that, you know, you're doing whatever you can to get to that next level. I don't get the sense that people are really present ever in their jobs. It's all about, okay, I'm here, now what's next? And it's always what's next, what's next, what's next. So to not accept what is next, it's not, you know, definitely counter to corporate culture.
Yeah, for sure.
And, you know, in the definition of really personally, for, you know, being seen as someone who lacks ambition as well. And I recently had someone say that to me. You know, I'm looking for someone in their personal life. They said I'm looking for someone that has high values, and I kind of corrected them, and I said they have different values.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that their values are not high. They're just different.
Yeah, right. So right. By high values, they meant somebody who like values excellence or always going above.
Expectation, high expectations. You know?
High expectations,
so,
yeah. That's great. Those are great. Yeah, I think you think about like Regina, you said you know, I might get fired out of doing this, or it may be like I may be setting myself on a downward spiral with the trust and those kind of things. Or you might get like ostracized, right? You might be put on the outside. Or the other thing, what do you guys think about for your own takes? I mean, those were both reactions for the company. How would you feel about yourself if you did something like that?
You want to go first this time?
Well, I'll step in. I think it depends on where you are, what stage you are in your life. At the stage I am right now, I have much more confidence. So I have a different, you know, I would relate differently. Right now, I'm going to do what is best for myself. But when I was younger, definitely a sense of failure. And fear. Definitely. What will people think?
Yeah.
How will this affect my outcome in the future? Some indecision and some pushback, definitely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How about you? Yeah.
I totally am right on with that too. But I also would think, just being a nonconformist, so often. Uh-huh. I know Olivia's got to feel the same way as I do because she is adventurous. And with that is, you're often a nonconformist. And sometimes you wonder, am I really that out of it? Because so many people don't think the way I do.
Yeah.
How is my boss going to look at me? Because I don't really think like 80% of the people,
Right. So you might think, you start to wonder if you really are that different, how is that going to affect you long term? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, you start to think you're the one that's crazy.
You're crazy,
for
right.
Having
okay.
different thoughts or
yeah,
not
yeah.
wanting what everybody else wants. You
right.
Think, well, maybe there's something wrong with me. Maybe I need to get this quote-unquote fixed.
Yeah.
My thinking, my perspective,
Yeah, right. And so what happens is, what do you do when you feel that way?
For me, personally...
Or you kind of go along, right? I mean, that's the pressure is to just do what everybody else does, even if you don't feel that way. Is that?
Well,
that's
or sometimes because I am a consultant and I've learned to kind of edit my comments when I didn't used to at all.
Yeah.
No filter between brain and mouth. And
Right.
And so I've learned to kind of develop a filter, but also... because I do look at things creatively, I'm able to use the very thing that maybe people frown on me about that don't understand, and I'm able to give a creative answer to a very typical situation and do it in a way that, may not be so frightening to them. And I don't know if that makes perfect sense or not, but it's a way of filtering, getting my ideas across, but doing it in a way that's more palpable.
Yeah.
For people who may not live in my mental space and are trying to grab hold of a new idea and are struggling with that. So I try to make it, take a idea and make it more palpable in that way to where it becomes almost their idea in a way.
Yeah, like a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down or whatever.
Yeah.
Just the way you say it. Yeah. Yeah, so... I think I agree with what you guys said. I mean, there's the first time this one time early in my career, I had a situation where I was I was doing a pretty good job with the role I had, and they were but I had a kind of difficult assignment, and they really wanted me to keep that, but they really wanted to sort of reward me that they knew I was, even though it was difficult, I was doing a good job. So what they do, they gave me another assignment on top of it, and they're like, well, we'll give you a staff for the new assignment, you know, but it's a special project and it's really high visibility. And I'm sitting here going, great, you know, so I've got these problem kids and this hard one and I've still got to deal with, and now they're going to pile on this other thing on top. But, you know, team player, I took that promotion and what I needed to do. And then a couple of just bad luck kind of things happened, and I really needed to go back and work more on my primary job. And so I just had to I talked to my boss about it, and we decided that you know, it'd be better if I just handed off this new thing to somebody else. And that was really hard for me, because I was like, geez, you know, there goes my career. You know, what are they going to think about me? I just had to fail. And so, you know, I talked to my boss, and we had a communication plan and how he was going to tell everybody to put it in context and how I was taking one for the team and all this stuff. And we had the meeting with the whole group, and he made the announcement. And I was expecting people talking behind my back or sneers or something. And what happened was everybody kind of was like, oh, well, you know, it was like, oh, nobody even paid attention. And then after it happened, you know, nothing changed for me. And I just had more time to do what I did. And there was no sort of pay implications for me or anything else. So really, in terms of dollars per hour I worked, I was better off than it was. You know, there was the ego hit for sure, and the fear was still there that something would happen. But that was the first time I really realized that, you know, most people don't think that much about other people. You know, everybody's pretty much caught up in what's going on for themselves and how things impact them. So, you know, yeah, people might say something about you, but in the long term, people forget. They have real short memories about anything, about anybody else. And so, that was a big lesson for me, and I think that's something that we don't often relate to, because we're thinking about ourselves and how things impact us. You know, everybody's thinking that way. So around the time in my life when I'd done that, I took a trip to this place called John C. Campbell Folk School, which is up in North Carolina in the mountains, and it's a place where you can go for retreats, and they have all kinds of stuff. You can do like metalworking, you can do photography, you can do bookmaking. You know, they've got these kind of craft projects, and you go to do one of these, and they have people come and teach. And there's probably 50 classes going on at the time. And so I went up there, and I had a roommate, and we were staying in this old mill house. It's made out of stone. And the person I was staying with, his name was Bob, and he was in his 70s, and he was retired. He lived in Myrtle Beach, and he had come to do some woodworking, and I was doing photography. But we shared a room, and we talked some. And I remember one time we were talking about careers and what we did, and he told me a story that early in his career, when he was probably in his 30s, he was working for GE, and he retired from GE. He was there for his whole career. And he had an opportunity one time where he and another guy were kind of going up for the same promotion, and one of them was going to manage the group. And for whatever reason, Bob didn't get the job, but this other guy did. And so, you know, Bob was kind of hurt by that. But what Bob realized was, you know, since I didn't get that job, what I'm going to do is I'm going to really focus on doing what I do best. And he was a scientist scientists who develop new ideas, new things. So what he really got graded on was how many innovations that he did. And they measured that by how many patents he got awarded. So when he didn't get the management job, he said, well, I didn't get the management job, and maybe I'm not going to get that. So in the meantime, let me just focus on doing the thing that the company really values most. And so he really worked on trying to do as many inventions as he could with as little time as he could. So he tried shortening his work week, and he told me it worked out that he really couldn't do it much less than 50 hours. But he worked 50 hours a week, and he did this, and he ended up, he retired with a bunch of awards. He had a long, really good career at GE, and I think he ended up with like 70 patents or something. So that's a really big number. And so what happened to his friend was probably about 6 months after his friend got the promotion, They brought somebody else in, and they laid him off. And then that guy who replaced him got laid off, and another kind of management shuffle that they did. And he realized that even though he hadn't done it to avoid management, that when you have a job that's really providing some real tangible results for the company, and that you really focus on that job and get good at, and really focus on what you're doing that brings the most value, you really are kind of immune in a lot of ways from these other things that happen, where people come in and you become kind of either you kind of overhead with some other people, or you're not directly, you know, you just get overhead, you get bumped off, or, you know, people change, the new boss comes in and they get rid of you because you're just a manager like somebody else. So hearing Bob's story of his career at GE made me realize that, you know, here's this guy from another couple of generations older than me who had made that decision and focused. And so that stuck in my mind. And as I thought about that, and then I thought about some other companies I'd worked at, I started to see that sort of option of taking yourself off the track maybe isn't the death of your career that I thought it was. So I had the experience that I had at that one job, and then I'm talking to Bob. And then, so what happened with me was that story I was telling at the beginning was that I was at a company and we had gotten acquired, and I was thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I realized I really didn't want to do the management anymore because I wasn't particularly enjoying that part of the job. I really liked the parts of the job that were more like me doing the work of the people who work for me. So I found a way to sort of give myself a demotion instead of having somebody else do it, while basically keeping my income, because usually companies won't cut what your basic pay is. And so I started to focus somewhere else. And so at the end, I'm going to tell you more about how that all turned out. But hang with me, just kind of suspend your fears for a moment, and let me talk to you about some of these ideas about how you can go about doing this downshifting. So what I wanted to do right now was this is kind of the basic downshifting, and this is really things you can do without much fear of repercussion. I mean, these are things you can do within a job when you're still in a role. And what I wanted to see if we could do a little exercise here and have you just write down like three things that you had to do in your most recent job that you knew didn't really add any value to the company or to what your job was, but that you just kind of had to do. So write those down. And then write down three things that you felt like you did that brought the most impact to your company, to the most impact to real results. So for me, it was in a lot of the roles I was, it was when I was actually physically in front of a customer. So then write down three things that, you know, where you were, the things you do that really are the things that really make a difference for your job. So take just a couple of minutes and write those down, and we'll talk about those. So I'll give you like 3 minutes to do that, and I'll come back. How are you guys doing?
I'm done.
Okay. Who wants to share something? Do the complaining one first. That's more fun. How about you, Regina? What are the things that you had to do just because?
I would say, well, I don't know if it would be complaining, but data crunching.
Okay.
Kind of what I do. Probably the only, I'm not complaining about that one, but probably one that may be a bit of a complaint or could be construed as a complaint is having to bring other people together who actually work in the same company that don't like to talk to each other.
Yeah.
And that became my job as an outsider to get insiders to talk to each other.
Right.
That I thought was kind of crazy. And then thirdly, in creating collateral, you know, or value propositions when a lot of times the customer doesn't even know what their value is and you have to try to help them find it.
Right, right.
You know, it was kind of, you know, traditionally people would give you information and then you'd make it presentable and all the rest. But, you know, I find myself a lot of my value comes in people don't know what to give me. You know, I ask them questions, they don't understand them, so I have to kind of interview them and create a brochure from it.
Yeah, right, right. I completely understand what you're saying. How about some of the things you do that you think bring the most value?
Probably the things that aggravate me the most bring the most value, you know.
Okay, yeah.
Like I said, it's not traditional, a lot of the things that I do, and because I understand, having been in the industries that I serve in other positions, I kind of know what questions to innately ask that somebody else may, that does the same kind of thing, quote unquote, that I do. Maybe everybody, you know, you can go to any ad agency or something and they can create a brochure, but the customer still has to know what to tell that person in order to create it. So the very thing that could be an aggravation point is a great point for me, because I don't have to wait for somebody to give me the information. I can just let them edit it after I create it for them, because it's easier for them to edit than create.
Yeah. So you really, it's kind of two sides of the same coin for you then. It's things you feel like are a little bit harder maybe, or the things that you can do different than other people too. Is that
right?
Right. All right. How about you, Olivia?
Wow. This is tough to come up with things that have no impact, because I'm so trained to look at everything in its impact.
Oh, good.
or make it look like it has an impact. So,
yeah,
but,
sure. Yeah.
Okay. But so definitely number one pet peeve, it was editing internal PowerPoint for aesthetics. In other words, not grammar or content, but just how they looked.
Okay.
All right. Fielding vendor calls.
Okay.
And then being a sounding board. Okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, and you know what? Hey, let's do a semicolon there and put meetings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, meetings. Made a difference, created budget processes, updated diversity tools, and was able to delete outdated storage that we were paying for those tools.
Yeah.
And then I didn't get to a third one.
That's okay. Well, that's great. I mean, both of what y'all talked about is really good. I mean, I think, things that like when you're building a new process, right? That's something that is the company's going to use, and you're going to build it one time, but it's going to improve a lot of people's work. So one small thing you do or something you put your energy into is going to have a multiplier effect. I mean, that's a good example of things that use your time really well. Same thing with tools that you're building, or Regina, with you working with a customer, when you are, you know, taking the time to talk to them up front, or taking the time to put down something to help them spiel on the process of deciding on something, it's going to make your work go much better later on. So it sounds like, you know, you're good at helping guide the customer or bring the people together or do what you need to do so that you're not having to redo collateral four times just because somebody, you know, I've been in situations where, you know, you get everything just right for one person, but it turns out there's this other guy who comes in at the last minute and wants to change it around. So you have to do the thing and maybe don't make money off of that.
No, so, I have to do that too. Very insightful though.
Yeah. So, but I mean, I think those are great examples. And it sounds like both of y'all kind of have developed a sense for, you know, the ways to do things, and the ways to do things so that the use of your time is getting more done of what you want to get done. And that's really what this basic downshifting is about. And so there were three things I do want to talk about that are real common. One was email. One's meetings that you brought up, Olivia. And then the other thing is too many commitments, which I think it's kind of like your sounding board comment that you made, Olivia. And I think those three, any kind of organization of any size, those are likely to happen. And anybody who has a, anybody who's really a good employee who works hard is going to get extra commitments continually put on them. And so I wanted to give you kind of a couple of ways, different ways maybe to think about those issues. And my favorite trick that I use, and you have to be a little careful about using it, but my favorite trick is what I call selective hearing. And you know how, like, if you have a dog, or we have a couple of dogs, and you know, you can try to get them. One of our dogs is a little terrier. She's a fox terrier. She's really spunky, and she chases squirrels and jumps on trees. And her name is Pixie. So Pixie, if she's outside, and I want her to come in, and it's at night, and she's barking, and I want to go to bed, I can yell all day long, and she's not going to hear, quote unquote, her name. But if I said something like food or dinner or anything, I could like whisper that, and she's going to come running for the door because she cares about that, right? And so what I did was relative to especially like emails and somewhere about meetings, and then this idea of getting asked to do other commitments is I would kind of have that selective hearing, because you know what Pixie was doing, basically Pixie's training me. So she's training me that if I want her to come inside at night, I'm going to have to wait until I say her name 10 times and come outside before she's going to come in. So she knows that she can have a little extra time to bark at the squirrels or chase rabbits in the yard. But if there's food, you know, I don't have to do that. She'll come right away for that. So what I did was, on email, kind of a best practice and something that I worked on was I realized that when I traveled on trips, a lot of times I'd be out of email contact all day long. And so when I get to the hotel at night, I basically had to go through all of my emails. And what I realized, I remember this one trip I was on, and I'd landed somewhere in Europe, and I had to have a dial-up connection. It was really difficult, but you know, because I had them all there at once, they were all batched, I could just kind of fly through and ignore the ones that weren't important. And because I had a short period of time, I really got back to the ones that mattered, which for me were customers and, you know, my bosses at work and anything kind of urgent. But also because I knew I could only do it at that time, I got them all done and I didn't leave anything until later. So one of the things that really I started to develop and use a lot is I only check my emails a couple times a day. And a lot of times if you work in a culture where people are expecting you to do a rapid response, or you have a BlackBerry and they want you to pop right back, there can be a little bit of adjustment period there. One thing I might do is tell the bosses and the people who really matter, tell them, hey, look, you know, I'm trying to get more work done, and so I'm only going to check my email a couple of times. So if you need me, you know, text me or call me on my cell phone. So you can kind of preempt that. But if you only check your email a couple of times a day, and especially if you do the first one at like 10 in the morning instead of 8 or 7, you get a couple of hours with none of those little kind of multitasking distractors going on in your head, and you can have some clear time to do stuff that's the really value-add stuff, so to work on a process or to really think about how do you get a customer to do the upfront work, to get clear on what they're trying to do. And just having that time be a focused, you know, 30 minutes or an hour with no kind of head noise from an email from somebody angry, you can do more in that 1 hour than you might have gotten done in 2 days if you were being distracted and having your mind share caught up in a lot of the kind of urgencies that come from the email. So that's a big one, and it's pretty simple to do. And my experience was, as I started to do that and people started to trust that I would get back to them a couple times a day because I was actually doing a better job of it, people just started not hitting me all the time. And so they'll go to the other person who is the quick response if they want a quick response, but they'll start to come for me for more of the important things, because I was sort of subconsciously training them that I wasn't going to be there on the spot to call them back. And kind of counterintuitively, what started to happen was people started to respect me more and didn't give me as many of the things that were the kind of dumb things, because they started to assume that if I was being responsive but I was kind of busy, that I must be working on important things. And so my kind of stature started to rise, surprisingly. So that's a really good trick to do. And then on the meetings, I did a similar thing. And this kind of gets into a little bit of the crossing over. Well, let me hold it. So for the meetings, what I would do is one thing you can do is just skip meetings. And this is the same thing. Have you ever, like, a good test for whether you can go to a meeting or not is if you have to go on a business trip or you're out of town and the meeting happens anyway and it didn't really make a difference that you were there. That was always my test, is if they could hold the meeting and get done whatever they thought they were getting done without me there, then I didn't have to go. And so I kind of, depending on how important it was or how visible the meeting was, you can use this policy of asking forgiveness instead of permission. And just skip a meeting or two, and if nobody says anything, then you don't have to go anymore. And if somebody complains, just make sure you were working on something important during that time, and so that when they complain, they can say, "I understand, I couldn't make it this week. Sorry about that. Here's what I had this thing going on, and I forgot to tell you, or I didn't tell you. So what did you need from me for the meeting?" And then that'll give you that chance to have the conversation about, you know, do they really need you in the meeting, or do they just need something for you? So those are good ways. And I know it's a little bit like, it's a little sneaky or whatever. It may not feel kind of upfront. And at first I was a little, you know, I like to be the team player and somebody they can count on. But what I realized is that the more I did that, the more kind of things got on my plate. And the less I was able to do what really mattered, and the more I was just sitting in meetings where I didn't really feel good at the end of the day that I'd gotten something done. So that increased stress. That meant I had to stay later at work to catch up on the things that do matter, because I still had to do that. And at the end of the day, you know, there were other people who were doing less work than me and getting more done. You know, I sort of started to notice that. So what do you guys think about those two? Do those seem as scary as the first thing I talked about, or they seem realistic, or have you tried those?
Well, I'll jump in. I can attest that I've tried some of what you're already saying, because there was a time when I would actually respond too quickly to emails and phone calls. And this is my interpretation, because when I couldn't respond, people expected me to respond within minutes, literally.
Right.
You know, and usually I did. And but if, you know, I went to lunch or anything, then I'd end up having, you know, 3 or 4 emails. "Hey, have you done this yet?" You know, usually I hear from you. And so I got like 3 or 4 times the amount of emails because I answered them, in my opinion, too quickly, because they, when they didn't get a response, then they started to get scared. I don't know.
Yeah.
This is making sense.
Yeah. You had trained them to expect that when you send Regina an email, you're going to get something back right away.
Yeah, and so
like,
I was on pins and needles the whole time. Pins and needles. I was always stressed because I thought, well, they expect me to get back to them. And I literally, and even now doing, you know, what I'm doing now, I do check my emails when I get up, you know, and then I take some time to get, you know, kind of centered for the day.
Yeah.
Grounded, because if I miss that time, it really, you know, my day doesn't go well when I just hop into work and don't get grounded for the day.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I feel out of balance. So
yeah,
I'm still learning what you're talking about. I'm still learning it.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
And
it's easy to get
it doesn't matter.
Too.
I don't get the follow-up emails for, you know, if I answer within a couple hours, that's just fine, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there is like an adrenaline rush of kind of when you're always getting emails and you're in touch with people, you know, it feels, I don't know, it's kind of exciting in a way, and you can just kind of go on that feeling. And I've been that way sometimes too. And then you know, like you said, then you're kind of addicted to it, or you're stuck to it, and you can't break out of it.
Well,
Olivia, can you,
all your customers are addicted to it, and
yeah,
you know,
yeah, you set yourself up really for
being
a bad. Yeah, that's right. And you, so Olivia, can you relate to that too?
I can. Would you like for me to?
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely, I can relate with Regina because most of my work has been customer focused. Most all.
Yeah. Right.
What the strategy that I use is to undercommit and overdeliver.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I will always try to keep in control of next steps. So my emails usually will be very short, succinct, and you know I will deliver this, and then I will give myself, depending on the project, anywhere from 2 days to a week padding, and then I will deliver it before the expected delivery date.
Yeah.
So that keeps a lot of emails down.
Yeah.
You know, and then I just control also. I use folders with my emails, and and there'll be immediate action needed or pending, and so that pending means pending someone else's response, something like that, and then I can come in the mornings and check those folders, and again it's all about controlling. So I'm the one that's controlling how the communication is going. Not that I do it 100% successfully, but it helps. And then, I've had to push back. I definitely give a tangible example. We brought on a new team of consultants, diversity consultants that I supported. And each one of them, they probably were on two or three committees. And they placed me on their mailing groups for all of these committees so that I could keep up with what was going on in their strategy and consulting. Fantastic. However, I also got every single hello, boo, hi about every single meeting, and I was coming in the mornings with 200 new emails.
Right.
So of course I evaluated the value of me being on those, and I pushed back and I removed myself, and then created commitments between the consultants and myself of when I will be communicated to and about what. Then at meetings, I couldn't imagine not. I tried to get out of a meeting, and that it was like no way. and I always, when I am negotiating something, the first thing that I'm doing is addressing the fear in the other person.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I wasn't able to creatively get out of it. Mm-mm.
Yeah, I think it definitely depends on your culture of the company you're at too. And I know when I worked at a big bank too, there were a lot of political reasons that people needed to be places too. You have to factor in what the cost benefit is of particular meetings and how you do it. That's right. I think what your example of the email is excellent, and really it is about negotiating with people. Either directly or kind of indirectly, what they expect from you, and how to do that. Was that something that you learned over time, or was that something that kind of came to you naturally?
I probably learned it over time, just dealing with, being in consumer product sales, and you have 120 customers and 120 stores, and each store has four managers. It's from that. Done a lot of outgoing call sales where you're, making kind of 100 calls a day. You can get, and not, like I said, I have gotten caught up in so many tasks during the day that really was low impact. Absolutely. It's very easy to do.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I think that your concept too of being able to the extent you can control the flow of work that impacts you is key. I mean, that's really what this is all about, is how do you take back ownership of your time at work so that you do spend the time you need to on the things that really matter, and then start to let go the other things. And so what I want to talk about now is another way to do that worked well for me. And this was having the explicit conversation with your boss about what your priorities are, or whoever your sort of stakeholders are. You might have effectively more than one boss or people who care, but there were a lot of times where I'd get these other commitments of, sit on this committee for me, could you help me with this, can you be here, can you be there, and all of a sudden, I look at my Outlook and it's blue all week. There's no time free to do any work. And so what worked well for me was to take the initiative and to really write down on a list, simple piece, one piece of paper, you know, what are the things I'm working on, you know, where I see the priorities are relative to where the what the company needs or where our stated goals are, that kind of thing. And then just to kind of go through and put it in black and white in front of our boss and say, here's where I think we need to go, and then sort of get buy-in from your boss that, yeah, that's the right order. Maybe he or she has a different order, which is okay. It's up to them to do that. And then kind of show them where your time's going and to help them get buy-in up front that this is where you should be spending your time. And then I would use that kind of as my get out of jail free card or my get out of meeting free card. And if I ever had to do something else, I wouldn't be lying about it. I would make sure I was working on those top priorities. But if I couldn't get to something that wasn't on that list, then I could use that. And I could kick it up a level to my boss to say, you know, here's the issue. Here's what I'm running into. Do you really want me going to this party planning committee meeting, or do you want me focused on delivering this big project that we have? And so that conversation can be, depending on who your boss is or how focused they are. I mean, Regina, if they're like your customers and don't really know what they're doing, I think sometimes you have to guide them to what is the right thing to do. I've certainly had those situations. But just having the process of ahead of time when there's not a big conflict, getting buy-in from that, then they've kind of made a commitment to you basically that your priorities are what they are. So, Olivia, it sounds like you've done that kind of thing routinely in your jobs. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And it was easy for me to get buy-in when, you know, you're supporting, you're facilitating the success of other people, and that's your main job, is to keep work flowing. It's mm-hmm. not difficult to get buy-in from them. You know, my manager, she and I last time, you know, every now and then, kind of things would get away from us, and we would, you know, kind of pull back and reconnect and have just, you know, 10 minutes in the morning. This is the way the day is going through these projects, just, you know, evaluating the day.
Yeah. And the other thing that
you know, would just make a big difference, huge difference.
Yeah. And it kind of takes some of the burden off of you to have to make those decisions, because I think a lot of times we'll take on that, really take on more responsibility than our job theoretically should have, because we really want our job to go well, and we know that it's impacted by other organizations or other people. And so there's a temptation to do more than our work, but to help somebody else who's not pulling their weight get their work done too, because it impacts our work. And I think that those kind of conversations with your boss can help share that load and let them really do their job as your boss to clear the way. But the other thing that this just kind of goes, like, if you're the kind of person who wants to get things done and you want to be successful and you really want your project to go well, I think this can kind of go counter to what your instincts are. But I think back to the big Y2K. Do you guys remember that? All the hype about how the ATMs were going to spit out money and nothing was going to work at midnight. So there's like 3 years of discussion about that. And then what happened on January 1st, 2000?
Nothing,
right?
Right?
Yeah, everything was fine. And there was I remember there was a really funny Nike ad around there, and this guy's waking up and he's sitting on his on his couch, and he's still got his clothes on the night before. He clearly has a hangover. He gets up and grabs a bottle of aspirin, and then he changes into his Nike jogging outfit. He goes out for a run. As he's going down the street, you see this tank rolling by, and then he gets a little further on, and there's an ATM spitting out money, and all of a sudden this SUV crashes into another car, and then traffic's gridlocked, and there's riot police out kind of beating down people. Everything's just going crazy. And then at the end, he's headed up a hill, and this kind of ballistic missile comes spiraling through the sky and up somewhere, and there's a giant giraffe there. But then he meets somebody else jogging, and they're saying good morning. You know, he's committed to that. And I think that was that image, right, that all the hell was going to happen, and then nothing happened. And it kind of like it really kind of undercut the credibility of all the IT guys who were saying all along that this was going to be a problem. And actually what happened was that the IT guys were really right, and there would have been a problem, but because they put so much energy into it and found solutions, they actually did a really good job. But they had to work really hard. And what ended up happening to the American IT business because of that was that's when India got going. They couldn't get all the work done that had to happen, and so they had to have more people. And ultimately, those guys all lost their jobs because the Indian guys did so well, and they're so much cheaper that all this stuff started getting offshored, and we all know that now, that that's going on. So one of the things that you can do in your job is when you get that temptation to, I'm going to stay late or I'm going to help this person do her job because it's going to impact mine. And if I don't do that for her, then I'm going to look bad because my part's going to fail. Sometimes you have to let stuff go wrong. I mean, you need to let Y2K happen a little bit, and you need people to be scared that something's not working so that you can kind of come in then and say, look, I see the problem. You know, if you help that girl do her job or that man do his job, then I can do what I need to do. So if you have the temptation to help someone else with their job, sometimes it's better to have that meeting with your boss and go through and say, you know, here's what's going on, and I'm concerned about the project because of this other piece that's not happening. And then let it go wrong. And then when it goes wrong, things will get fixed. Because when you follow that temptation to do somebody else's job too, not only are you spending more time at work, which we're trying to do less of, but you're also making it more likely that you're going to fail, and you are letting that problem kind of stay hidden, or even if it's not hidden and people know what you're doing, it's not a pain for them anymore. It's not a problem. So you need to let the Y2K thing happen. You need to let a couple of ATMs blow up or something happen so that they'll take it seriously and you'll get the support you need to be able to do your job without overworking. You guys follow my logic there?
Yes. Yep, absolutely.
And can you relate to that sense of, you know,
yeah,
when you're needing to do somebody else? I mean, I've done that a million times, you know, that, you know, I really want this job to go well, and it's just a downward spiral for your time. So
yes, you can miss some of the things. You can miss the things that are your job because you're trying to do someone else's to try to
exactly.
save your own job and hurt yourself anyway.
Right, exactly. And, you know, a lot of stuff's out of your control, but it's really hard to let things fail. Well, you know, you could do something about it, but you have to draw a line and say, you know, I'm going to take care of what I need to do, and I can't control everything, and I'm going to, you know, it's the same thing. If you're a good employee, you are going to get sucked into work, and the more work you'll do, nobody is going to stop you from doing that more work, you know,
sure,
because you're good and you're doing it. So you have to own that process of setting those limits, and part of that may be a short term, something going wrong or something happened kind of bad overall for the company that you're just going to let happen so that you can do what your job is. And I think that the kind of ironic thing is that, you know, we all work for managers at whatever level in the hierarchy, but if you were to talk to most CEOs, they would completely agree with you. And they would all say, you know what, don't do that. That doesn't make any sense. Because the CEO's job is all to think about the value of the company and growing the company, and they would understand that. The problem is that it gets filtered down as we go through the hierarchy, and people have different agendas, and there's political stuff, and people worry about their jobs, and a lot of that can get distracted. But if you focus on those fundamentals of what's important to the company and here's how I can best serve the company right now with the time that I have and the energy I have, you're not going to get you can almost never go wrong by doing that. And that's where this kind of comes all the way back around to what we were talking to earlier, is that, you know, if you are in a job that's a management job and that, you know, doesn't hold your passion anymore, it's stressing you out more than it did, it's requiring you to act differently than you really are or in a way that's not in your best interest, it might work for a little while, but in the long term, you know, you're going to quit the job. You know, you're going to leave. You might leave the company. You might burn out. You might flame out and not do a good job. You know, something bad is going to happen in that situation, even if you feel like, you know, I'm the kind of person who can really get things done. And so just like Bob at GE, over the long term, you're going to be better off finding the place where you can do a good job in a way that you can manage your time and put your best work in and do that. And what my experience has been is that there's very little downside to taking a role that's one where you're more directly contributing to the work. So, you know, if you're doing sales, you're working on bringing in revenue. If you are building processes to help the company grow and you can become an expert at that and you actually do things, no matter what happens with the management, if you're the experienced person who has the knowledge and you've been there and you really do focus on adding value in terms of, you know, value more than just the work you did, but you're building things for the future. Those are the kind of people that never get laid off. And you never, you know, you're not going to get your pay cut because they don't want to lose you at that point. You're a valued employee. So that brings us to the advanced downshifting techniques. And this is really kind of related to the Peter principle. Do you all know what that is, the Peter principle?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's basically in an organization, everyone rises to their level of incompetence, which means you keep getting promoted as long as you're doing a good job until you're not doing a good job anymore, and then they just kind of leave you there. And so there's actually a thing called Peter's Corollary, which says that in time, every post or every job tends to be occupied by an employee who is incompetent to carry out his duties, and adds that work is accomplished by those employees who have not yet reached their level of incompetence. I mean, and I think we can relate to that, right? That, you know, you work for the idiot boss, but all the people who work for him do everything. I don't know what he does, right? Have you felt that way before?
All the time.
Yeah. So what you want to do is not be the idiot boss. You want to be the person who's at your sort of peak level of what you do well. And so in a lot of ways, when I demoted myself from running sales and marketing in this one part of the organization and put myself on a special project doing work that I could do really well, I, in essence, was taking myself back down the Peter principle ladder to somewhere where I could really make a big difference. And so in the short term, there was a lot of kind of angst, both real and imagined. And what I've learned, because I've done this three times now, what I've learned is that the right way to think about a career isn't so much like the career ladder. It's more like those guys who climb the poles in the Cirque du Soleil. I mean, they can go up, they can go down, they can go sideways, they can jump over to another pole for a while. And what I found is that nothing succeeds better than actually getting results, because over time, you know, you can play political games for a while, you can do the right thing, you can kiss up for a while, but things will change and people know what's going on. And the people who are the real workers, who are really getting results and getting things done, they will rise to the top and people will seek them out. And I've seen that in every organization I've worked in, no matter how political it was. If people got stuff done, they ultimately were rewarded. I mean, it makes sense, but sometimes in the short time frame or in the moment, it doesn't feel that way. It feels like, I need to play the game. I need to take this other role, because all the fear-based stuff takes over. And so the hard part is kind of making a stand to say, I'm not going to live by that way anymore. And a lot of what I've been doing in these courses is building up to this point, but that's why it's so important to start things outside of work while you are still working and doing this, because when you start to see yourself not as your job and not as a VP or an SVP at this company, but as, you know, I'm a teacher, or, you know, I'm an artist, or I'm somebody who helps people become fit, and that's really who I am. And my work is just, this is what I do, and it's a patron that supplies me the money and the time to do my art. That mindset is the biggest change, I think, and it's not necessarily something that you can do overnight, but it's something you can work towards. And what that does is, it's not really that it gives you the courage to do things different. I think it's just a change in perspective of what, of, you know, how the work fits into your life and how you do it. And but let me tell you some other practical reasons why it really works in practice. So, of course, we talked about the concern about your ego and what might happen bad. And so there's always the what might happen to me. And there's the, you know, you might have a boss who really likes you doing what you're doing right now, and if you want to do something for somebody else, they might be threatened in the short term, and so there may be some negotiations and transitions, and how do I do that, because other people have agendas for you too. But if, say, let's say you work through those issues and you've made the change, here's what I found out, that, you know, one of the things I was concerned about too is, after you get through the ego and the issues with your boss, is, you know, am I going to get bored doing something that I did before? You know, I've done this before. I can do this with my eyes closed. It's really easy. And I have other things going on in my life, and I like the time, but, you know, am I just going to be, you know, twiddling my thumbs during the day? So what I found out is, though, that even when you go back to something that you've done before, and maybe you're going back from being a manager to somebody who's a direct salesperson or a marketing person or whatever the role is, when you come back, you're not the same person anymore. And whatever you did in management or other parts of the business, all that you get to keep and you get to bring back to you, and it gives you a much richer perspective. And what I found is, even doing a job similar to what I've done before, I don't do it the same way, and I don't and I have a kind of a confidence that I didn't have before. And I think about my kids, and my oldest daughter is starting high school this fall, and every one of the traditions that I have had over the years is I always take pictures of them on the first day of school. And I have this one picture of Erin when she was starting kindergarten, and she was this little teeny tiny kid. And I remember walking into school, and there's these fifth graders, and she's a kindergartner, and the fifth graders are huge. They look like adults compared to these kindergartners, and they're so little going in there, and they're scared, and they don't know where to go, and they don't know what to do with their lunchbox, and they don't know where to go. And, you know, now they have this spring festival, and Erin always wants to go back, even though she's in middle school. And there she is, you know, and she's this big kid, and they're looking up to her. And now she has some teachers she can call by the first name, you know. So she's back at the same place, but she's a different person now. Even though she's the same place she was, you know, she just understands herself better. She's older. She's more confident. And you see that happen even over 1 year in school. But it's the same way with the job. I mean, I went back from being a manager to being a direct salesperson. But now, you know what, I'd been a manager before. And not only did I really know how to do the sales really well, but I also knew how to do management really well and what would work there. And I could tell things that didn't work very well for us. And so I had a confidence and an air and a way to talk about things that was kind of the language of management now that I wouldn't have learned if I hadn't done that. So in addition to doing a good job, I could better influence the type of things that needed to happen to make it easier for me to do my job. And so I wouldn't have to feel like, you know, I was stuck doing somebody else's job like we talked about, but I could now talk about, hey, you know, have you thought about the big picture? We really need to do some product development, and it seems like here's what's happening to us. And, you know what matters to the manager. You know what matters to the CEO. It's like, you know, why are we investing all these resources here, you know, and to continually sell the same old stuff when we could put a little bit of them over here to develop a product, and we have a new division of the company. And so what actually happened for me the three times I've done this is kind of the opposite of what you worry about or what I worried about. It's not that I have become irrelevant. The problem is right away you're back on the track again, and you're like in this role, and you're all of a sudden you're really kicking butt again, and you're so much better than everybody else because you really know how to do it, and it's really what you like to do. And and they're like going, wow, man, you know, we need to put this guy in a management position. You know, he needs to come out and move to California and run a group. And so the harder part for me wasn't so much that I was about to get laid off or I was on the outs. It was more like people wanted me back doing these bigger roles. And the harder part was the conversation every year, okay, Alan, what do you want to do with your career, or what do you want to do next? And I was always kind of like, well, I kind of like what I'm doing right now, because, you know, and I didn't want to tell them necessarily that I liked it. Part of it was I liked it because I didn't take a lot of it didn't stress me very much, and I had a lot of free time to do stuff out of work, and I didn't have to put as many hours in, and that outside of work, I was working on other things that were more meaningful to me, and I was starting to be who I really am in the real world. Outside of that, I was using my passion and my energy and the things I really cared about more than I ever had, because now I had the energy and the time from work. So what happened, though, is, you know, here I am doing this same job I've done before, but better with a new perspective. And all of a sudden, you know, not only did I not take a pay cut, halfway through the year, I'm getting a bonus check for what I'm doing. And I'm starting to be noticed by people higher up than the people who I'd worked for before. So so that is the, you know, it's a counterintuitive, scary thing to do. And the results you get are totally the opposite of what you might expect. The problems that it creates, in my experience, have been the opposite of the ones I worried about, and in some ways harder to deal with. It's like that they want you even more at that point, so you have to be committed to something outside of work to do that. Do you guys you follow me?
Oh,
are you feeling it?
I'm feeling it.
Okay. Are you? How about that? Does that change how you thought about things when I talked about this at the beginning of the call, or do you still feel like, that worked for Alan, but it won't work for me?
Well, this is Olivia. Okay, this is Olivia. I feel differently. One of the things that I am concerned about is being bored, taking on a role that I've had before, and I really think that I want to get back into sports, and so that might require me to take on, you know, a role that I've already had, and yeah, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm overqualified to do that. I'll be bored, you know, been there, done that. But now that, you know, you've kind of put into light that I have a rich perspective and have more influencing skills, that brings more value to it, makes me a little bit more excited about perhaps taking on that role again. I'm a little more open than I was before.
Okay, good. I think the other thing that maybe I didn't say it directly, but the other thing that you'll see is that because you have almost no learning curve, and you will quickly be recognized for the value that you're bringing. And I think you'll have more opportunities than you think you might. So there's the fear of boredom, but if you really get into it and it's something that's at least in a different place or something a little bit different, I think you'll find that you very quickly move past that and are able to do more than you think you would. Olivia, I guess the other thing I would ask too is, like, maybe think about what you want to get from doing that, you know, or what are your bigger picture goals from doing that, and have that be your guiding light of, you know, here's the reason I'm doing this, and, you know, I have a bigger plan for my life, and this is how it fits into it, and that kind of, I know, the picture of the patron or of a stepping stone or a piece that you need to complete the puzzle can kind of help you too, or, you know, if you can bring yourself back to that every so often and think about what is there for you.
Okay. Thanks.
So I guess the last piece I want to leave you with is, if you wanted, these are some things that make it easier to make that kind of shift backwards in a company. The first one is, it is true about everything about saving time at work, is the company, you have to think about the company first. And you have everything has to be put in terms of, how can you add more value to the company in terms of all those things? You basically save money, save time, or make money for a company. So that, but as long as you keep that in mind and align your motivations to have less stress and more time with that goal of the company, you really can't go wrong. And because if you are focused on how do you best use your time to add value to the company, everybody up to the CEO is going to appreciate that, and you'll be different than 90% of the people at work who are just focused on what do they have to do. So just thinking about that way, even if you don't do anything else, will make you a better and more valuable employee, and will make it more likely that you won't lose your job while you're trying to do something else outside of work. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, when you want to make a move like that, you're probably going to need to have a new sort of sponsor for you or a champion for you. And for me, there was a lot of kind of hard feelings about me moving from one boss to the other, but ultimately I had the ear of people who cared about me doing the new role. So I had to think about who's going to benefit from me focusing more on this other role, and I brought them into the conversation too. In this case, it was a chief operating officer who could, and I did the same exercise with him where here are all the things I can do. Here's where I think I could really add the most value right now. And he agreed with me. And so ultimately, that gave me some coverage and some support to make a change like that. And that helped the transition time. And then the other thing too is to think about, it's always good to think about plan B. This is the third thing, is to think about, you know, what else could you do or what else would you do? And if, you know, if you can't make this work, it's good to know that, okay, I can make it here another 6 months, or I can do that. Or if I can't make this kind of change, maybe I do need to think about making a change in my job right now. And I don't think a lot of times those plan Bs need to be put into place, but there's something about knowing that you've thought through what else you can do and you feel confident in that, that gives you a different, I don't know, you come in from a different place when you go to negotiate a change like that, when you know that you are still controlling what you do and how you do your time. I mean, you can always quit. You can always leave at some point, or you can choose to stay in what you do it, but it's going to be your choice at that point, because you can't necessarily control them letting you go do another job. They could threaten to do things or whatever else, although I don't think that's usually what happens. But if you have that sense of what your purpose is and where you're going and what you want to do, it's much easier to have that knowing that you're okay if they say no. You're okay either way. So that those three things are really helpful. So look, are there any other questions or comments?
No, a lot to soak on this one.
Yeah. I know this is a whole different, this is like I said, this is like grad school for saving time and money. I mean, it's not nobody typically thinks this way. It's something to be avoided, not something to do on purpose. So what I was going to suggest for kind of homework this week is that you think of some teeny tiny thing that is annoying or doesn't add value, and even if it's a 10-minute thing or a 5-minute thing, and see if you can try one of these ways of doing it, either renegotiate it or skip it once and see if anything bad happens, and then just do that on purpose just to see how it feels and to see that the world doesn't end when you do that. Because I think what for me, it was definitely a process of working up to some of the changes I made and where I was. And like me, I thought through my plan B, and I kind of knew, you know, I'd done kind of what I've talked to you guys about. I had started something on the outside, and I didn't know exactly where it was going, but I felt confident in the direction I was headed. So I knew at some point I would switch over so it wouldn't be the end of the world, but I wanted to be careful about how I did it. So anyway, think about something small that you might try and just do a little experiment. That's something you could handle the worst case scenario, what happens, but do it just to see how you react.